Earlier, the new king, alongside Queen Consort Camilla, met well-wishers gathered outside Buckingham Palace, paying their respects after the passing of Queen Elizabeth II on Thursday. Gun salutes, floral tributes, and flags flying at half-mast symbolize the country in the first phase of an official 12-day mourning period. Messages of condolences flooded in from world leaders, with domestic tributes being led in the House of Commons by the new Prime Minister, Liz Truss.
Today, we show the world that we do not fear what lies ahead. We send our deepest sympathy to all members of the royal family. We pay tribute to our late Queen, and we offer loyal service to our new King.
These are unprecedented times, and the parliamentarians will be getting used to saying God save the King instead of God save the Queen. But what will a monarchy under the stewardship of Charles III really look like? Charles's ascension to the throne comes following a 7-decade-long reign by the late monarch.
Lots of people who maybe were not great fans of the monarchy as an institution respected Queen Elizabeth II for her longevity, for her record. They forgot many of the things that she was also associated with, the end of empire, which is often very brutal in places like Kenya. But they gave her some respect, and you'll see that, I think, over the next 12 days. You'll see people prepared to give that respect to the Queen. I think it's going to be a very different story going down the road, and we should remember that the monarchy is very important to the British elite. The armed forces, the security services, judiciary, they swear loyalty not to Parliament, but to the monarchy.
Charles's new role as king comes at not just a tumultuous time for the throne, but for the country itself.
If he's going to be an effective king, he will have to speak to the nation in a way that brings people together. And that may involve him, and as Charles has known to do this in the past, be a very much more politically overly political monarch than some of his predecessors. He's made interventions on various issues, and I think he'll continue to do that going forward.
At home and abroad, there are questions about what Britain's new monarch's vision will be. Will the tentacles of the new reign bring forth a new dawn? Former subjects across the world will simply wait and see. Amina Taylor, London.
A shroud of terror has descended onto the streets of Leicester, with Muslim residents of the English town living in fear for their very safety. Racism, cricket hooliganism, and violent street assaults, all targeting Muslims of mostly Pakistani origin, has become commonplace in this once peaceful city. Amid the hate crime spike, Press TV was informed by concerned locals that the attacks appear to be conducted by Hindu thugs radicalized by foreign extremism. At this stage, we cannot verify the political affiliations of the perpetrators. However, speaking to local Muslim residents, they've expressed major concerns that what might be inspiring this latest round of attacks could be Hindutva supremacism from India. The rise of anti-Muslim violence taking place over there could have a ripple effect affecting the Indian diaspora community, particularly here in the UK, which boasts a sizable British Indian community. Hindutva has become a significant ideology inside India, seeking to establish Hindu hegemony over the country. Many of its advocates preach intolerance towards rival religious groups, especially Muslims, who've become a prime target of India's Hindu extremist rhetoric. Local activists informed us that they believe it's the same Hindutva hate which has caused the rise in Islamophobia here in Britain.
The Muslims and the Hindus in Leicester have been getting along for decades. We've not had no issues. It's these latest crowds of these young Hindutva ideology thugs, RSS, the BJP thugs. This mentality, they come with this mentality, they're trying to bring it down here, and they're very, very racist, and they're the ones who are causing the problems in the community.
This year, at least 3 severe attacks have occurred, with at least 2 victims being hospitalized. The media has so far only focused on a recent outpouring of anger by local Muslims, venting their frustrations via scuffles with the police on Monday night. But if the alleged problem of Hindu radicalism isn't dealt with soon, Muslim vigilantism may become the go-to option for some furious locals. Robert Carter, Leicester.
It's been dubbed the most right-wing cabinet for a generation. Formed after new PM Liz Truss's fulsome support for her predecessor and a purge of defeated rival Rishi Sunak loyalists. Some of the familiar faces, Kwasi Kwarteng, a free marketeer and Truss's ideological soulmate, confirmed as chancellor. Ex-leadership candidate Suela Braverman, admired by the right wing for attacks on, quote, woke politics, appointed home secretary. Staunch ally James Cleverly, promoted as foreign minister. On his entree, Ukraine and fixing relations with the EU, strained after Brexit, among other things. Close friend Teresa Coffey will be deputy prime minister and health secretary. The National Health Service is reeling under a staff and cash crisis. And another carryover from the Johnson administration, Jacob Rees-Mogg, the man who blamed the energy crisis in the UK on climate alarmists, will be business and energy secretary.
What we therefore have is a very clearly defined agenda with Liz Truss surrounding herself by people she thinks will be loyal to her and will share some quite central policy objectives, which I'd suggest are sharper than those of her predecessor.
The makeup of the Truss team goes against her pledge to use what she called all the fantastic talents of the Conservative Party.
Liz Truss won less than 60% of the Conservative Party membership vote, and when she threw her hat in the ring for party leadership, she won fewer than a third of the Conservative MPs' votes, which means that she could have done herself a favor by trying to appeal to as wide a base of parliamentary support as possible.
Especially because she will need her party's support for her plans for her three priorities, the economy, energy, and the NHS.
So they might grumble in private, but they'll show the impression of unity in public. The biggest issue, though, for her is that if she does controversial things in legislative terms, which MPs think aren't going to work, then she could have problems.
The 56th UK Prime Minister takes up the reins of power as the UK toils under spiraling levels of inflation, skyrocketing energy costs, an economy almost certainly in recession, and public services on the brink. It remains to be seen if she and her cabinet can deliver on her promises. Saeed Bourizab, London.
The Seoul Defense Dialogue Security Forum addressed the North Korea issue Wednesday as leading military strategists grappled for a coherent policy toward Pyongyang. In South Korea, President Yoon Suk-yeol's hard line involves strengthening the U.S. alliance and bolstering military capabilities, including a potential preemptive strike.
Kill Chain will pre-detect North Korea's nuclear missile launch and be able to interfere with it, blocking any incoming nuclear attacks. And in order to prevent the worst case, we are intensively organizing the defense budget and developing military strategies to prepare a military retaliation.
President Yoon promised to normalize operations of the U.S. anti-ballistic missile system, THAAD, which was deployed in 2017, with new equipment brought in late Sunday night in an attempt to foil local protesters. Yoon has said he would like to deploy more THAAD missile batteries. At the forum, President Yoon's hard line was echoed by Japan.
There could be a lot of sanctions that would be imposed together with other countries, and there could be certain measures which some countries can do unilaterally, and it's a kind of a combination, but we have to share the same goal of urging North Korea to accept the terms. We have to figure out where it hurts most for the North Koreans.
Several forum speakers stressed coordinated sanctions, which have so far failed, yet offered few alternatives. Settling the issue of North Korea's nuclear and missile programs and ending sanctions against Pyongyang will require bringing North Korea to the negotiating table. But so far, the U.S. and its allies, South Korea and Japan, appear unwilling to provide much incentive for North Korea to re-enter talks. Also on Wednesday, the nuclear envoys of the U.S., South Korea and Japan met in Tokyo to coordinate strategies seeking to denuclearize North Korea. The U.S. repeated its offer to meet unconditionally with North Korea, while U.S.-led unilateral and U.N. Security Council sanctions remain in place. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Italian government has introduced a number of measures aimed at curbing electricity consumption this winter amid soaring gas prices and fears of more disruptions. Italy relies on natural gas for 40% of its electricity production. On Tuesday, Roberto Cingolani, the Minister for the Ecological Transition, announced energy-saving measures ranging from turning down thermostats in apartment blocks and public buildings by 1 degree and shortening the time the heating can be on by 1 hour a day and 15 days across the year.
It could be a solution, but on second thought, I don't know how useful this measure would be. What I do know is that it's always us people who pay the price.
Hospitals, nursing homes, primary and play schools will be exempt from the energy-saving measures. The policy introduced by the Italian government is part of an EU plan which calls on member states to voluntarily reduce their gas demand by 15% compared to their average consumption in the past 5 years between August the 1st and March 31st next year. However, the gas demand reduction becomes mandatory if supplies reach crisis levels.
Abbiamo deciso di fare a meno.
Italy has decided to do without the Russian gas, which amounted to about 40% of its supplies, and opted to embrace a supplier diversification strategy. Also, Germany did the same. Now it takes 5 members of the bloc to demand the European Council to make the energy saving plan mandatory. For instance, if Russia opts to cut altogether its gas supplies to Europe.
There are concerns on how the implementation of energy-saving measures will be monitored by the government. For now, the Ministry for the Ecological Transition has called on individuals to play their part. It remains to be seen whether this will be enough. Max Civili, Rome.
Growing up in poverty is among the many things distinguishing presidential candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva from his opponents. The difficulties he and his family faced from a young age undoubtedly influenced his policymaking during his government. The former president's cousin took us to visit the small clay house Lula lived in until he was 7. Located in the rural area outside of Garanhuns, in the northeastern state of Pernambuco.
So the shack next door here, which built in a very simple way, was once the home of our President Lula, along with his mother, his father, and his 7 brothers and sisters before he emigrated to São Paulo, naturally to save of hunger.
Conditions in this part of the countryside were difficult. There was no running water, and it was only around 2006, under Lula's presidency, that rainwater collection systems were built in this and many other communities.
In 1952, I would have to go out to get water. I had to go 18 kilometers on a donkey to get 4 jugs of water every morning. I'd leave at 2 or 3 in the morning and would be gone until 6 or 7 a.m. with the 4 containers of water, with the donkeys all dying of thirst.
Despite the Workers' Party's advances on economic rights, poverty alleviation, eradicating hunger, and in bridging inequality generally, conditions are now deteriorating under the neoliberal government of Jair Bolsonaro.
Today we live in a similar fashion, but things improved after Lula became president. Every house around here that didn't have a rainwater cistern has 2 of them now, and that has helped the people a lot to be able to work. It helped against poverty. Through the banks, it gave credit to poor people, and that is how Brazil got better. And now with Bolsonaro, things are getting as bad as back in 1952, when Lula left this area.
It's candidate Lula da Silva, who many working-class Brazilians are saying they identify with most. Camila Escalante, Pernambuco.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the US, public health agencies generally don't test sewage for polio. Instead, they wait for people to show up sick in doctors' offices or hospitals, a reactive strategy that can give this stealthy virus more time to circulate silently through the community before it is detected. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Robin Fields Ryder. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Reactive Polio Strategy Could Be Silently Putting Many at Risk. Here's more. Polio's first appearance in almost a decade in the U.S., confirmed late last week by health officials in New York, would play out quite differently. In the U.S., public health agencies generally don't test sewage for polio. Instead, they wait for people to show up sick in doctors' offices or hospitals, a reactive strategy that can give this stealthy virus more time to circulate silently through the community before it is detected. In New York, the first sign of trouble surfaced when a young man in Rockland County sought medical treatment for weakness and paralysis in June. By the time tests confirmed he had polio, nearly a month had passed. Because the majority of polio infections cause no symptoms, by the time there is a case of paralysis, 100 to 1,000 infections may have occurred, said Dr. Ivan Malando, a professor of pediatrics at Stanford School of Medicine, who chairs the American Academy of Pediatrics Committee on Infectious Diseases. He said, "You are already chasing your tail if you're going to wait for a case to show up." Nationally and globally, there are signs that the pandemic has opened up new vulnerabilities to diseases long in retreat. Routine immunizations have been hindered by a host of obstacles, including COVID-19-related lockdowns and growing vaccine resistance stalked by misinformation and politicization. A recent analysis by UNICEF and the World Health Organization showed that the percentage of children worldwide who received all three doses of the vaccine against diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, a measure of overall immunization, dropped 5 points between 2019 and 2021, and that measles and polio vaccinations fell too. The organization say that's the largest sustained decline in childhood vaccinations in the roughly 30 years they have been collecting data. That could create greater risk of polio, a scourge of the first half of the 20th century in the U.S., highly contagious and potentially life-threatening. Polio historically has victimized mostly young children, attacking their spinal cords, brain stems, or both. The virus spreads when fecal material or respiratory droplets from infected people get into water or food or onto other people's hands, which they then put into their mouth. This may sound unusual, but it's among the more common ways viruses circulate, especially among children. Around 70% of those who are infected show no signs of the illness but can infect others. Of those who do get sick, most have mild symptoms such as fever, sore throat, muscle weakness, and nausea. But about 5 in 1,000 infected people develop irreversible paralysis. At its peak in 1952, polio killed more than 3,000 Americans and paralyzed more than 20,000. Images of children encased in coffin-like iron lungs terrified parents. Those fears faded swiftly after the first polio vaccine was approved in 1955. Within 2 years, cases dropped by as much as 90%. Since 1988, when the Global Polio Eradication Initiative began pouring billions into immunization campaigns and surveillance around the world, polio has been eradicated in much of the rest of the world. While polio, the kind that occurs naturally, remains endemic in just 2 countries, including Pakistan and Afghanistan. But there is another kind of polio that's circulating, one linked to the type of vaccine that's used in much of the world, particularly lower-income countries. This oral vaccine, which hasn't been used in the U.S. since 2000, is easy to administer. Just a few drops on the tongue and cheap to make. It uses weakened live viruses to trigger the immune system to create protective antibodies. That brings a bonus. When the vaccinated shed the weakened live viruses in their stool, they can spread to the unvaccinated, triggering protective antibodies in them as well. But it also brings a risk. In rare instances, when the weakened viruses circulate in people who have not had the vaccine or are under-immunized, they revert to a form that can sicken unvaccinated people, causing the disease they were meant to prevent. The injectable polio vaccine used in the U.S. contains only inactivated viruses and cannot cause this. Cases of vaccine-derived polio have surged in recent years after global health authorities in 2016 decided to remove one strain of polio from the oral vaccine after determining that the wild version had been eradicated globally. That left a growing number of children with no immunity to the vaccine-derived version of that strain, type 2. Type 2 vaccine-derived poliovirus is the kind that was found in sewage samples. It was also the kind that infected the unvaccinated Rockland County man, indicating a transmission chain from someone who received the oral polio vaccine, health officials said in New York. Officials are still investigating where the man caught the virus, in the U.S. or abroad. The Washington Post has reported that the man traveled to Poland and Hungary this year, but a spokesperson for the Rockland County Health Department said in an email the person did not travel outside the country during what would have been the incubation window. Ultimately, New York health officials will use wastewater monitoring to tell them quickly whether they have a bigger problem, essentially allowing them to test thousands of people at once for polio infection rather than individually. David Larson, an epidemiologist and Syracuse University professor who directs the state's wastewater surveillance network, said in an email. Wastewater testing for polio has been a staple in developing nations for decades, but at least a few countries where cases are rare and vaccination rates are high to do it too. COVID-19 has triggered a blast of interest in wastewater surveillance. prompting cities, states and colleges to launch programs and opening a floodgate of funding for them. The CDC sent federal money to health departments in over 40 jurisdictions to support such tracking efforts, working with them to collect data that's published on the agency's National Wastewater Surveillance System website. A spokesperson said in an email that the agency was working to expand the platform to include data on other pathogens, from foodborne infections like Salmonella to influenza, but not polio. Testing nationally for polio would be labor and resource intensive, requiring increases in public health lab capacity, the spokesperson said. One asset of wastewater monitoring is the ability to pivot quickly to test something new. In November 2020, the SUER Coronavirus Alert Network, based on Stanford and Emory Universities, started daily monitoring at California wastewater plants for the virus that causes COVID-19. It's since added monitoring for other pathogens, including COVID-19 variants, the common respiratory virus RSV, and most recently, monkeypox. Such additions are relatively economical since the network can test for multiple pathogens from a single sample, said Malrin Wolf, one of the two principal investigators and an assistant professor at the Rowling School of Public Health at Emory. In adding more tests, Wolf said, the question is always whether monitoring a disease this way is likely to surface anything of enough concern to drive public health decisions. Many question whether the expansion of wastewater testing fueled by the pandemic will last. Malondo, the American Academy of Pediatrics Infectious Diseases Committee Chair, said the recent polio case is another signal that more disease tracking is critical, saying, maybe this is a clarion call for us to really restart building better surveillance networks.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The passing away of Queen Elizabeth II may be a sad day for a lot of people, especially in the UK, but at the same time, there are many who do not think about the Queen in positive terms. Some examples: the massacre in Northern Ireland, chemical attack by British forces in Iraq, the role it played in a coup against Iran's Mossadegh government. Well, those are just some of the things that happened during her watch over the UK. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will review some of the atrocities committed by the UK while the Queen resided at her palace and ask, was her role really ceremonial? And isn't it time to abolish the monarchy? A question that many are asking at this point. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Assistant Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Tehran, Arya Barzan Mohammadi, joins us. And we have Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute at the London Metropolitan University, George Zamir Yeli, who joins us from Budapest.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. George, let me first start with you. We are taking a look at the headlines on mainstream media that are mourning the Queen pretty much nonstop from the time this occurred. And, of course, now Charles' accession to power. But then there are those that are calling for abolish the monarchy, which is a hashtag that's now trending loudly on social media. What are your thoughts on that aspect of the news about the Queen's death and, of course, Charles ascending to the throne?
Well, I don't think, to be honest, that there will be much change in British foreign policy were the monarchy abolished. I don't think the Queen ever really had much of a say in governmental policy. In fact, the Queen, even in realms where she might have had a say, an influence, for instance, in the Church of England. I mean, she's the head of the Church of England. She really, you know, took a hands-off approach. She was very much a ceremonial monarch, very popular for being so. But in terms of the foreign policy and all of the objectionable aspects of British foreign policy during her lengthy reign, and you mentioned a few of them, she really didn't make those decisions. And therefore, you know, whether under King Charles or a republic, and, you know, all governmental decisions made by Prime Minister Liz Truss, I don't think there would be a huge difference in policy.
Well, there are some calls, however, that are being made to that effect, but more so, and maybe worth mentioning in a sense, If you can tell us what you recall, Mr. Muhammad, about some of the atrocities or conflicts, perhaps, that happened during her watch. There's a list of them, some of them that perhaps stand out as you had the Iraq and Syria, where Operation Shader took place from the year 2014. You have the Persian Gulf War, the Sierra Leone Civil War. I'm looking down a list here, the Suez Crisis. Of course, the Iraq War, Yemen, and Afghanistan wars worth also mentioning. Is it correct to see these as being what she oversaw and could have done something about, or completely detached from these occurrences during the time that she obviously was alive?
Well, I agree with your other guest that Queen's authority is very much ceremonial on the paper. However, we mustn't forget that she used to meet with Prime Minister on a weekly basis and provide advices. That's one thing, how she could have had some influence on decision making. And also what we didn't see or what she should have done is to express her disagreement with some of the atrocities that you have mentioned, you know, loudly and publicly. I mean, I couldn't understand. I mean, what happened in Kenya just maybe days after she took the throne, she became the queen, and the atrocities against the Mau Mau movement in that country. As I mean, according to the New York Times, the response by the colonial authorities over there led to the establishment of vast system of detention camps and torture, abuse and killing of tens of thousands of people. And even the British government eventually agreed to pay £20 million in lawsuit compensation to the survivors of that atrocities. So in response or in answering your question, yes, the Queen enjoyed only ceremonial powers, but as a human being, she should have done more to at least detach herself from some of the atrocities that her governments have committed, from the coup against Mossadegh to what happened in Kenya, to the apartheid regime in South Africa, the exercises, the acts against human rights over there, and you can mention many others, and not only that, we shouldn't forget the legacy, the historical legacy of the British Empire. So we shouldn't just look at her reign from 1952, but we should go further or back to the history, look back to the history and see what kind of atrocities and crimes that the British Empire committed from the times of King George II,
sure,
to the times of Elizabeth II.
Well, Joyce Amoyeli, we're looking at what our guest said here about Mau Mau, and this happened right after her father's death. So you have her then take over the throne, and you have what our guest there referred to as a source in terms of how he explained it, and that was the New York Times, leading to the establishment of a vast system of detention camps, as our guest there quoted the New York Times, torture, rape, castration, and the killing of tens of thousands of people. Since that was right after her father's death and when she took over the throne, could she not have then played a role in preventing from that happening then?
I doubt it. I think that had she interfered in any aspect of British policy, whether in foreign affairs or in domestic affairs, it would have led to the swift demise of the monarchy. At least, you know, she would definitely have believed that was the case. I mean, the British worked out a formula for what they called a constitutional monarchy, even though Great Britain actually doesn't have a written constitution. It's a constitutional monarchy, which means that the monarch is essentially a non-political person, doesn't in any way interfere in any aspect of governmental policy. I mean, the governments are formed, they go to the Queen, establishes the government, and then, you know, when governments are closed down shop, you know, they go and tell the Queen that that's it, the government is dissolved. That's her role. If she were to start saying, well, I don't like this policy and I don't like that policy, it would have brought about a constitutional crisis and would have led to the demise of the monarchy. And I think she saw her role as someone who wants the monarchy to continue. She, you know, she wants to be the person who inherited the crown from her father and who will then pass the crown on to her son. Uh-huh. And doubtless Charles thinks that he's going to pass the crown on to his son. I mean, that's the way the system works. You can't really expect them to operate according to rules that you may like, but they obviously don't identify with.
Sure. Well, here's the problem that many see, and maybe you could shed more light on this or explain this to us, Mr. Mohammed, and that is the fact that, according to the way our guest describes it, if this was a one-off or maybe something that occurred twice during her 70 years when she had the throne, it could be dismissed as such, perhaps. And many may maybe look at it in a different way, but there are many who are holding the monarchy, and in particular her, responsible, since this has occurred so many times. For example, one of the social media reactions: if the Queen had apologized for slavery, colonialism, and neocolonialism, and urged the Crown to offer reparations for the millions of lives taken in their names, then perhaps I would do the human being thing, or the human thing, and feel bad, As a Kenyan, I feel nothing. This theater is absurd. There are many people who hold her responsible. Do you think then, therefore, that she, again, could have exerted some type of influence when you're having repeated acts that spell that are of this nature?
Of course. I mean, she was a human being after all. I mean, let me disagree with your guest, with the professor, because just years ago when, the voting for Brexit took place, everyone knew that Queen was against Brexit. So probably if she could have voted, she would have voted again for no Brexit or not exiting the European Union. So people in England knew about Queen's opinion regarding Brexit. And she must have expressed it in the closed circles. And then this has found its way to the newspapers and, tabloids, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't see what was the problem with, making her opinion known to the people regarding some of these, atrocities that you are mentioning. And I understand the role of monarchy in a constitutional monarchy in Europe, but we shouldn't forget that these things are not, issues of budget or appointing this minister or removing that minister or canceling this or that program. These are really, really severe, decisions with the severe consequences that, one should have reacted to them and as a human being and had a moral responsibility to actually oppose them if she thought that these were, against her moral stance or ethics, or agreed with them. So that's one thing. The other thing is that the monarchy, if we look at it even as a ceremonial or in something that is written not in a written constitution or in a constitutional monarchy. If you look at other countries, such as Scandinavian monarchies, we see some sort of a socialist monarchy. We don't see the same luxurious expending and the lifestyle that we see in British monarchy. And also, they have less of controversies from now and then. We know that the controversy surrounding the issues regarding Prince Andrew and other things. British people, many of them, would demand more clarity and more responsiveness regarding taxpayers' money being spent on luxurious weddings or ceremonies or lifestyles, while at the moment, people are struggling with their providing fuel for their cars and paying for their electricity bills. This is not to say that we are going to say to the British people what system they should choose for themselves. This is up to the British people. But we shouldn't forget that the British monarchy's legacy is not exclusive to Britain. It goes beyond that. And currently, King Charles III, he has a lot of challenges to deal with. Namely, first of all, a second referendum, Scottish independence referendum is on the table. So we might see a potential breakup of the United Kingdom, mm-hmm. The unraveling of the Commonwealth, and reckoning with the unsavory past, parts of the royal family's past and its colonial legacy. So we have to see what kind of King Charles III would be. Is he going to remain silent on most of these issues or quiet, or he will decide to speak up and try to apologize to people of India, people in Africa, and other Commonwealth and other former colonies.
George Samioli, one of the questions that has been asked, and perhaps you can clarify for us or explain to us what the real reason is, and that is why the Queen never visited Israel. I mean, you read one source that says because the Queen did not like what Israel did in the occupied territories in terms of, the violation of Palestinians as a whole. Others say it's because of trade deals with the Persian Gulf Arab countries, didn't want to upset them. But many sources are pointing towards the violations of Palestinians, which then doesn't fall in line with the rest of the violations that took place on different countries that were part of the colonialism that the UK exercised.
That's a very good question, and it's it may be all of those things. She also probably has it's a sore point with her about the terrorism that took place during the time of the British occupation of Palestine, during the time of the Mandate, Israeli terrorists. Well, they weren't Israeli then, but the Stern Gang, actually were murdering British officials, and that may well be a sore point with her. I don't know. It definitely is odd, but it wouldn't surprise me if there was some issue that. That she feels strongly about what happened during the years of the British Mandate in Palestine.
Okay. Well, you talked about Prince Charles there, Ali Barzani Mohammed. There's a social media, again, reaction to him taking over the throne, and that is why should there even be a throne for him to take over? What is going to be the purpose? I mean, does that serve the 21st century type of... governance that should exist? You know, those questions are resurfacing, especially right now. So isn't that a valid point of view for many to have, especially at this point in time where the UK, like many other European countries, but the UK is suffering economically so badly that many would question why should taxpayers' money go towards whatever it is that he's going to be doing?
It's not a secret to anyone that King Charles III doesn't enjoy the same popularity that his mother enjoyed inside the UK, at least. I mean, her mother, opinion the world has about her, was very popular inside the UK, or at least in England, if we exclude Scotland and Ireland. But Prince Charles doesn't enjoy even the same popularity inside England. And the reason, part of that is because of the story of Diana and the divorce and the family matters, private matters. And other part is that he is very, his style is very politically active style. So he likes to talk, when he was Prince of Wales, the Crown Prince, he usually commented about politics, about what type of ministers should a certain prime minister choose, or what type of policies is preferable. So he was very talkative about it. And one of the famous sentences or that he mentioned was after the return of Hong Kong to China, when he joked with it and called it a Chinese takeaway, which made the Chinese government very angry with that comment. So his activism might create some sort of controversy for him. It either could make him more popular if his activism is on the side of the people, if he decide to cut some of the budgets that for luxury spending and lifestyle, and try to treat members of his family, especially his brother, like any other person from the public, or his activism might become a source of a problem for him, especially with regard to issues such as Scottish referendum, countries like Australia might choose to break away from, you know, the, not the Commonwealth, but to choose another system for themselves instead of, you know, a monarchy and choose the common republic. So there are a lot of issues that might resurface during King Charles' reign, while there was an agreement that there should keep kept quiet during her mother's reign, because of the prestige, international prestige that she enjoyed, and King Charles III so far doesn't enjoy it.
Okay, final question goes to you, George Samueli. When you take a look at how the Queen was, and as you explained it, and as the actually the role warrants, is for it to be a ceremonial role. But isn't there a possibility that Prince Charles might not maybe hold that on paper, but might exert his opinions, his thoughts? Do you think that that may happen? And again, given the current political, not paralysis, but the electricity that exists right now in terms of just the economic pressure that's exerted on the UK, again, just like many other European countries, that perhaps he may come in and take a more active role in that regard. What do you think?
Well, that's a possibility. The problem is that if he were to take a more active role, I think that would make him that much more unpopular, because it's known that, you know, in terms of how he sees the world, he's a very much a World Economic Forum type, one of the Davos group. And I would think that he would push towards a kind of a net zero, you know, answer to energy problems, which means that he would be pushing for renewables. The problem is that that's kind of one of the reasons why Britain has got itself into the mess that it's got into, which is that it hasn't invested sufficiently in the tried and true fossil fuels. It's gambled everything on renewables, and that's turned out to be a rather